Do you remember that old Steve McQueen movie, The Great Escape? You know, the one where he was shot down over Germany in World War II and spent the entire movie, it seems the entire war, trying to escape. And every time he tried, he got caught, and then they would stick him in a place they called the cooler. Or if you're under 40, maybe you're more familiar with something called Orange is the New Black. It's a prison series about a women's prison. And every time they do something wrong, they get spent to the special housing unit, or SHU as they call it. Those are our popular conceptions of something more properly called solitary confinement, but are they accurate? Is that the way solitary confinement's used? Is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate to use solitary confinement? Lots of constitutional issues here, and we'll speak with Alex Reinert about them. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's solitary confinement.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Alex Reinert is a heck of a fellow. He is a former United States Supreme Court clerk. He's a law professor in New York City. He's a former litigator who's litigated one of the most famous cases in all of American civil procedure. We'll actually talk about that today for a little bit. But the reason I asked Alex to be on the show today is because among his many other remarkable accomplishments is his work that he's done with the New York branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, all on the issue of solitary confinement. It seems that the popular conception of solitary confinement as a severe punishment for severe offenses that's limited in duration and kind of like a timeout for adults, that concept is probably somewhat misleading. In fact, it seems that maybe solitary confinement is used a lot more frequently and for a lot more minor offenses than you would think in a lot of different places, and that perhaps this causes an enormous amount of psychological damage, damage that's actually contrary to most of the objectives of our penological system. Alex and I are going to talk all about that today, and you're going to be surprised at all of the constitutional issues that crop up.
I'm Alex Reinert. I'm a law professor at the Cardozo School of Law in New York, and I teach constitutional law and civil procedure and a class on the rights of prisoners, and I'm also an advocate for prisoners in the courts and in other venues.
Now, that's all accurate, Alex, but you're being unduly modest. You not only were a clerk for Justice Breyer at the Supreme Court, but you actually argued a case that has a great deal to do with constitutional law, even though it won't be our focus today, the Iqbal case.
That's true. I did do that. Yes.
Well, just briefly, because I'm interested in civil procedure, and I know you are, just very briefly, what was that about, and how did you argue in that case?
So the Iqbal case was a case about the treatment of detainees who were held after September 11th in a federal detention center in Brooklyn. There were hundreds of detainees who came through this federal detention center. And the claim in the case, and I was representing the plaintiffs in the case along with some other folks, the claim in the case was that these individuals were treated as terrorists, even though there was no reason to suspect them to be terrorists, and that the reason that they were treated as terrorists was because of their race, their religion, their national origin. They were all people of South Asian or Arab descent, and they were Muslim, and our argument was that they were just, the minute they came into the detention center, they were classified as terrorists, which meant that they were held in solitary confinement, that they were subjected to extremely significant restraints on their movement. They were subject to strip searches every day, and many other things. And so the claim that we brought was against both low-level officials and some high-level officials, including the former Attorney General John Ashcroft and the director of the FBI at the time, Robert Mueller. And so the case, as it wound its way up to the Supreme Court, I had litigated it from its inception. So I started litigating the case when I was still in private practice. And by the time I became an academic, it was on its way up to the Supreme Court. When it got to the Supreme Court, the issue was, had we alleged enough facts in our complaint so that we could get past the initial stage in the proceeding, which is the motion to dismiss stage.
Let me interrupt you there, Alex. That's what it's most known for. That's what civil procedure teachers across the nation cite Iqbal for, is for making it harder for a plaintiff to get past that motion to dismiss. But of course, it has all that fascinating terrorist stuff in the background. But please continue.
Sure. So it's basically, the question is, getting over the threshold from the motion to dismiss and into discovery. And as anyone who litigates knows, most cases are won and lost at the discovery stage. And so basically what the Supreme Court said was that the complaint did not allege enough facts against Mr. Ashcroft and Director Mueller, and also adopted a standard for pleading in the federal system for what complaints have to contain that has had ramifications throughout the federal system. It was a 5-4 decision. Justice Souter wrote a very, very impressive dissent that was joined by three colleagues, and Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion. And it was an amazing experience to argue. It was very disappointing to lose the case 5-4. We had prevailed at the district court, and we had prevailed in the Second Circuit. When it went up to the court, we were, of course, concerned. And when the decision came down, we were extremely disappointed. And of course, since then, I've done a lot of work looking at the impact that that case has had on the federal system as a whole. And that's been interesting to me, not just because of my involvement in the case, but also because of my interest in civil procedure. So,
yeah, and the standard had been for a very, very long time much, much easier for a plaintiff. That is, it was much harder for a court to dismiss a case at an early stage. And so now after Iqbal, that standard has been ratcheted up for the plaintiff. And as you say, we simply don't even get to discovery. And so now we've established you're the guy who's messed up civil procedure
exactly.
for the entire country.
Yes, well, that's what I take responsibility for, I guess.
All right. Well, thanks, Alex. Now, that was a bit of a diversion, and I didn't mean to ambush you there. But,
no, that's quite all right.
But that has a fascinating background and fascinating implications for civil procedure. But civil procedure is a little dry for most people, and certainly for most people listening on the radio. So let's get to the more recent triumph that you had involving solitary confinement. Could you tell us a bit about that, please?
Sure. So this is a case that I'm working with the New York Civil Liberty Union with, and also the law firm Morrison & Forster. It is a case that was filed initially by the prisoners themselves, a challenge to solitary confinement, and the New York Civil Liberties Union, which I'll just call NYCLU, came into the case and asked me to litigate it with them, along with Morrison and Forster. And we amended the complaint and made it a class action, which we're basically challenging the way that New York State uses solitary confinement throughout the entire prison system. And so what's happened is, after we filed our complaint, we immediately entered into settlement negotiations with the state, and after protracted negotiations, came to an interim settlement agreement, which makes a lot of changes to how solitary confinement is used in the system, but also provides for a 2-year period in which we are continuing to both gather data, work collaboratively with the department to institute additional reforms that we hope will reduce New York's use of solitary confinement in the prisons.
Well, that is quite an accomplishment. Let's back up to the beginning, and let's try to define some things and what the problems are. What exactly do you mean when you say solitary confinement?
So solitary confinement in the New York system means that you are held in a prison cell, sometimes with another person and sometimes alone. So sometimes it's not technically solitary. But in any event, you're held in isolation in a prison cell for 23 hours out of 24. And occasionally that 1 hour out of the 24, you are permitted to go to another location, which the department refers to as recreation, but which I think anyone outside of prison would not recognize as recreation in any sense of the word. So for some prisoners, this means literally a door opens in your cell, a mechanical door opens in your cell, and you walk out of the cell to the outside into a cage that is a little bit smaller than your cell, but in which you just are now outside instead of inside the cell. There's no equipment for you to use. You're not recreating with anyone. You're just in a different location. In other facilities, it might mean being escorted to a very, very small cage in which you walk around the cage by yourself, again, without any equipment or any real way to do what most of us would consider recreation. So in any event, that's what we mean by solitary confinement in the New York State system. Sometimes you're in your cell for 24 hours out of the day, not just 23 out of 24.
Now, what is it used for? How does a prison inmate get put into solitary? Why?
Well, so there's a variety of ways one can end up in solitary. The principal way in New York that one ends up in solitary is for violating a prison rule of some kind or another. New York has a lot of rules. Prisons have a lot of rules, as anyone could imagine. And so if you, say, refuse a direct order or refuse to submit to a drug test or sometimes just talk back to an officer, you could end up in solitary. You certainly could end up in solitary if you assault someone, if you are found with a weapon. There's all sorts of ways one could end up in solitary. That's the principal ways. Some people end up in solitary just because there's no place else to put them. Some people end up in solitary because they're at risk of attack by other prisoners in the facility. But the principal way is by violating some prison rule.
All right. Now, I don't mean to sound flip, and I don't mean to trivialize this, but it sounds like putting a kid in timeout. It sounds like just saying, okay, you go over there and be quiet for a while, and you're not going to talk to anybody. Is that basically what we're talking about?
I don't think it can be analogized to that. I mean, so a couple of things that are important to understand about the transition from general population to solitary, which is in general population, your time out of cell is you know, usually at least 7 hours, sometimes upwards of 11 or 12 hours. In general population, you have access to programming like drug and alcohol treatment, educational programming. You might be working. In general population, when you recreate, you are recreating with other people. You have exposure to other human contact. When you transition to solitary, you lose many of those things. And probably most importantly, the amount of dehumanization that occurs in solitary. If you're alone, there's walls and a steel gate between you and any human contact, and you're fed through a slot. If you are ever touched by another human, it's by an officer escorting you somewhere in cuffs. So it's extremely harmful. There's lots of data that suggests that it's extremely harmful. If you're housed in solitary with one other person, in some ways it can be worse. I mean, it is literally maddening for many people who experience it. There was the head of the Colorado Department of Corrections wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about spending less than, I believe, 24 hours in solitary. Just he wanted to know what the experience was, because he knew that people in his prison were being sent to solitary, and he, it was unfathomable to him how extreme what an extreme deprivation it was.
How quickly does that effect begin to happen? Because I think you've convinced me it's not like time out, but one aspect of time out with a child is that it's only for typically a few minutes, and I'm guessing that the duration is very important when it comes to solitary.
The duration is very important. I mean, it is. It's hard. It obviously varies from prisoner to prisoner. So the best data that we have suggests that the harmful psychological effects begin pretty quickly. I mean, for some people it can be within 3 or 4 days. For some people it can be between 12 to 15 days. And after 15 days, for many people, there are serious harmful effects, or at least serious harmful effects have been documented. That's one of the reasons that the international laws basically prohibits solitary confinement for more than 15 days, considers it cruel and inhuman treatment. The sentences that people serve in New York State are typically much more than 30 days, sometimes more than a year. So the sentences are extremely long. And after a while, the amount of harm is immeasurable, I think, that people experience. And one has to sort of understand that for many of these prisoners, they will eventually return not just to general population, but they will eventually return to the public. And it's extremely difficult for people to adjust from that period of extreme deprivation to the stimulation that is in general population of prison, let alone the stimulation that when one is out and free on the street. And so one problem, of course, is releasing people directly from solitary to the street, and their ability to cope with that transition, it's extremely difficult.
Is Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Alex Reinert all about the compelling issue of solitary confinement. Is it constitutional, or is it constitutional the way that we use it? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Alex Reinert. Stick around. Well, is that Doug?
It is.
It's Doug, and Doug has brought with him some, well, what do we call him? Action figures.
I'm your father.
That's right.
I'm your father.
I brought in my my childhood action figures from Star Wars. This is an original
Doug Smith set.
Not just that. This is an original Darth Vader with the lightsaber still intact.
It's mostly intact. It looks like it's kind of busted there at the end.
Yeah, I'm an old guy.
It looks like it really got played with.
Today, we're going to be talking about family dynasties, if you remember from the Star Wars show.
Yes. The Skywalkers. Uh-huh.
Darth Vader tells Luke Skywalker that he's his father, and it radically rocks his world. And Darth Vader realizes there's another, a sister.
Oh, yes.
Princess Leia.
There is another.
This is going to be important because when the new Star Wars movies come out, we're going to find out this connection between the Skywalkers, particularly Princess Leia, Luke Skywalker, and the legacy of the executive transitions of the dark side.
There is another.
Indeed. That was very good.
Thank you very much.
I thank you.
So this morning we're talking about political dynasties.
Okay, so there is a nexus here. There is a constitutional nexus. Do we have someone who is conversant with Star Wars on the line?
Not really.
Oh,
well,
you're in trouble today then. What is your name?
Brianna.
Where are you from, Brianna?
Big Rock, Virginia.
Big Rock, Virginia. Well, they showed Star Wars in Big Rock, didn't they?
They did, but I'd never watched it, sadly to say.
You never what? I think there's a requirement in the 14th Amendment to be a U.S. citizen that you have to have seen Star Wars at least once. So I don't think you should be voting until you've actually seen the first trilogy, the real one.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll see what happens. Now, Doug, do you have a question for Brianna?
I did. Luckily, Brianna, this is about family dynasties, not specific to the Star Wars.
Oh, okay.
Wars.
All right. Okay.
Though I believe if you love freedom like Stuart and I do, you'd see those Star Wars movies.
Yes, you would, if you were really a good American. But we stray.
How many times? Here's your question. I'm going to read it and give you four choices. How many times has the immediate family member of a president become president, her or himself?
Oh, my gosh.
How many times has the immediate family member of a president become president, her or himself? Your choices are one.
Okay.
A is one. B is two times. C is three times, and she was a lady. D, it is forbidden by the Seventh Amendment.
So you can't be president if you've had an immediate family member as president.
Based on the Seventh Amendment.
Based on the Seventh Amendment.
So A is once, B is twice, C is three times a lady. D is it's forbidden by the Seventh Amendment.
Forbidden?
Okay.
Only the Sith speak in absolute.
I'm sorry. I was doing my Yoda here, Brianna. Don't interrupt me when I'm doing my Yoda.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's perfectly all right. Okay. You have any? I was trying to give you a little bit of extra time there. Do you have any idea about this?
I know that it's definitely not D because it's not forbidden because it has happened at least a couple of times.
Okay.
See, there were the Adams, John Adams and John Quincy. That was his son.
Mm-hmm.
So that's at least once. And then there were the Bushes.
Oh, the Bushes. Yeah, that's okay. That's twice at least. But was it three times a lady? I don't know. Was there a third one?
I can't think of a third one.
I'm looking at the quiz guy and I'm not getting any hint from his face. He's just smiling.
Oh, goodness.
I'm trying to help you here, Brianna.
I am strong with the Force.
I am going to go with B, 2.
B, 2.
That is exactly right.
Tremendous. Well done, Brianna.
And she gets the bonus point for knowing that it's the Adams family.
Yes.
And the Bushes.
And she gets double bonus points if she tells me what the Seventh Amendment actually does say, since it doesn't forbid this.
I'm not sure of the exact wording.
Uh-huh.
It has something to do with trial by jury.
Oh, good heavens.
I had to memorize them in high school, but I don't remember the wording.
I think, Brianna.
The force is strong with this one.
I think Brianna gets 2 t-shirts. That's what I think, because she just nailed every aspect of this.
She did great.
You're going to get your constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. That everybody gets that. You're going to get 1 t-shirt for answering it correctly, and then a 2nd t-shirt for all the extra stuff that you knew to justify your answer. That was absolutely tremendous, and you learned all of this in your high school civics class.
I did. Don't tell her that I didn't remember the wording. We had to memorize all of the presidents and all of the amendments.
Well, what was your teacher's name so that I can't tell her?
Her name was Rhonda Colley. She was amazing.
Well, Rhonda Colley, congratulations. You did a great job with Brianna, and I'm sure you do great jobs with all your other students as well. So congratulations to you, and thank you, Doug, for that very interesting question that had nothing to do with Star Wars.
Nothing to do. Well, dynasties. It was about dynasties.
Okay,
We're going to be talking a lot about dynasties on the run-up to the 2016 election.
I see.
Hillary Clinton, dynasty. The Clintons has now thrown her name in. We've got Jeb Bush. That would be the first time that actually 2 sons of a president.
That's true.
And so all of these dynasty questions start to rise, and it actually makes its way into the public debate about whether we like having the same families running the country all the time.
That's a bit of an issue for a lot of people.
Not a new debate. John Van Buren, of course, who was the son of Martin.
Right.
He thought he wanted to be president at one point. And then Robert Taft.
Right.
Of course, the son of President William Howard Taft.
Wanted to be president. He was a big, big leader in the Senate of the conservative Republicans.
He tried 3 times, but never could win the Republican nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
Fascinating indeed. Well, thank you, Doug, for all of that enlightening information.
There you go. May the force be with you.
Jokes. Let's get back to our serious discussion about solitary confinement with Alex Reinert from New York City. Before the break, Alex was telling me that solitary confinement is no laughing matter and that it can cause serious mental problems, especially if it's used or overused for a long duration and in inappropriate circumstances.
So yes, duration matters. Underlying mental illness matters, and as people probably are familiar with these data, the percentage of prisoners with mental illness just keeps rising, in part because public investment in mental health treatment outside of prison has decreased, and we don't have as many hot state hospitals that treat people with mental illness, so a lot of those people end up going to prison, and so prison now has a lot of people with mental illness, so it affects people with mental illness very profoundly, but it affects lots of people who don't have underlying mental illness as well. So
how about children? How does this, is that ever used for juveniles?
Well, that's one of the significant aspects of the settlement that we have achieved with New York State so far, which is they have agreed now that they will not use it for juveniles unless there's exceptional circumstances. And in fact, New York City just agreed that they won't use it not only for juveniles, but for people up to the age of 21, which is quite significant. That was also the result of a lot of lobbying and an effort that I've tried to be involved with as well. So it does affect juveniles. Part of the problem, of course, for juveniles is their brains are still developing. And so putting them in a locked cage and not letting them out for 23 hours of the day again, affects their development profoundly. And it's, you can't just draw the line from a cognitive perspective. You can't just draw the line at juveniles. Most cognitive scientists would say the line goes up to 21 or older. So it is a real problem for that young population. And of course, in New York, it was a problem because New York is one of the states that puts more juveniles in adult facilities than almost any other state. That's a whole separate problem in New York State. So,
you mentioned one aspect of solitary that I'm sure some people are thinking might be desirable, and that is the protection of inmates. Is solitary ever a good thing?
Well, I would not. I mean, that's a complex question to answer, and so let me answer it in a complex way.
Please do.
Solitary is never a good thing for the prisoner. You can protect a prisoner from risks without putting them in solitary. You can take measures to protect someone from the risk of harm from others without requiring that that person suffer the harms of solitary. That's the first issue. But the second issue, and let's acknowledge how difficult this one is, there are, of course, people in prison who are dangerous to others, to other prisoners, to other staff. And prisons need a way to address that risk and need a way to address those individuals. And so solitary has traditionally been used for that. It's a very small percentage of the prison population. In the public's imagination, it may be quite high, but in reality, it's quite small. Those repeatedly violent offenders who have killed people in prison before, or who are at risk of killing people in prison or doing serious damage. In any event, those people, for sure, we need to address in some way. And so one of the positions that we've taken is for those individuals, yes, there needs to be separation, but we need to distinguish between separation and isolation that accompanies solitary confinement. So we need to deal with those people in a way that preserves everyone's safety and security, but we also need to try and work with those individuals to address that behavior and to help them figure out a way not to behave in that way. Now, to some people, that's going to sound extremely unrealistic, right? But there are systems in which that attempt has been made, and it's been successful. Not, of course, it's never going to be successful for everyone. There are always going to be at least some very small percentage of people who will be resistant to that kind of change. And for those people, we need to both protect them and protect staff and protect prisoners from them, but we need to do it in a way that minimizes the harm. And I think there's a public image of prisons as full of extremely violent people who are dangerous to everyone. And that's just not true. And the problem with solitary is it's used for all sorts of people, some of whom pose very little risk. I'll give you an example. The two of the plaintiffs in our lawsuit put in solitary literally because they had legal papers in their cell. Now, what legal papers did they have? They had legal papers that prisoners were using to file in state court and basically file these writs in state court that interfered with the financial dealings of public officials. So it would make it harder for, let's say, a DA or a district attorney or a corrections officer to get a mortgage. It wasn't actually taking money from anyone. It was filing a lien. Right, and it was a lien that had no basis. Right, some of these prisoners would file liens that had no basis, so it was a problem what they were doing, but it wasn't a problem that was about the safety and security of the institution. And by the way, it's a problem that's addressed by the criminal law. In other words, it's illegal to do what some of the prisoners were doing, not necessarily what our clients were doing, but some of the prisoners were doing with these legal papers.
Let's just be clear. I'm curious now. I mean, because I was not aware of this, so. You have a prisoner sitting in a cell who's going to go out and try to file liens on prosecutors and other people in the criminal justice system just to mess with them, just to cause them problems.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's why it was a problem to have those legal papers in the cell.
Correct.
Okay, so these guys were put into solitary.
They're put in solitary, and they put in solitary for more than a year. If someone is going to take those papers and file them and file false liens and mess with the the personal lives of public officials. It's a terrible problem. Is it a problem that needs to be resolved by solitary? I would say no. Is it a problem that needs to be resolved by more than a year in solitary? I would say, I would hope everyone could agree, absolutely not. So in any event, there are all sorts of things that people end up in solitary for that don't conform to the public narrative about who's in prison. And the other thing that happens, of course, is if you look at, 100 years ago, let's say, the Supreme Court of the United States had this decision. It was more than 100 years ago, in which they said, states have experimented with solitary confinement, and they've all found that it's been a disaster. It's driven people insane. It's caused more harm than any good.
This was 100 years ago?
This was 100 years ago.
Well, what was it? Well, just for the lawyers out there, what's the name of the case?
In re Medley. It was a habeas corpus case. It was an ex post facto, again for the lawyers, it was an ex post facto challenge to a criminal sentence. And the Supreme Court has all this language about solitary confinement, about how harmful it's been shown. And this is not, they're not making it up. In fact, historically, that's true. There was an experiment with solitary confinement in the mid-1800s in the states, and the states realized it was driving people crazy. And so they stopped doing it. And then 100 years later, right, we have a Supreme Court decision in Wilkinson, in the Wilkinson case, in which there's a challenge to the procedures by which someone is put in the supermax in Ohio, and the Supreme Court describes the supermax as probably the most extreme deprivation of human contact that one could imagine. And
was the supermax prison where pretty much everybody was in solitary?
Where everyone was in solitary, there was a process by which you could end up in there, and the prisoners were challenging the process by which they ended up in there. They weren't arguing that it was cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. That argument had been raised in the lower courts, but it had been resolved before it got to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court, in resolving unanimously this procedural due process case and deciding that the process that was used was sufficient to put these people into this supermax, describes the conditions and describes it without any sense of outrage or without any sense of history about how far we've come from the 100 years, from the In re Medley years in which people had realized that it was it was driving people mad. And of course, then the other thing that's happening is that if you look at solitary confinement sentences 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, they were measured in terms of days and maybe weeks. But now we're talking about solitary confinement sentences that are measured in terms of months and years.
So just to back up then, so you're saying in the 100 years between Medley and Wilkinson that the Supreme Court seems to have forgotten its earlier concern about solitary, or has simply changed its opinion about its harms?
Yeah, so I think it's a fascinating question as to what's happened in those 100 years. I mean, one thing, of course, is the issue that was presented in Wilkinson is different from the issue that was presented in re Medley. So they were talking about the same thing, but they were talking about the same thing in a different context. But that, to me, that's too easy of an answer. I think what's happened is, and this is true, I think any observer of the criminal justice system would agree with this, I hope. It's so much easier to become more punitive than to become less punitive in the criminal justice system. And I think solitary is a great example of it, as is mandatory minimums, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you will live to regret that this wire ever came.
How come?
Because you're going to spend the rest of your life in deep lock.
Who says so?
The Attorney General. Remember the judge's sentence? And kept in solitary confinement until you are hanged by the neck.
Yeah, but that ain't what the judge meant.
That's what the Attorney General says he meant.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with Alex Reinert, who is a lawyer and law professor in New York City. And he's telling me all about all the problems that I was only vaguely aware of with solitary confinement, as well as its constitutional implications. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Alex Reinert. Stick around.
Montpelier is home to the 200-acre James Madison Landmark Forest and to some of the best free hikes in the Virginia Piedmont, close to Charlottesville, Virginia. The Hiking Trail Network is set in one of the premier areas in the Piedmont, representing a relatively undisturbed old-growth deciduous forest. The forest has been designated a national natural landmark by the Department of the Interior. The forest also has been protected with an easement through the Natural Conservancy. The 200 acres of trees found in the James Madison Landmark Forest have been virtually undisturbed by man since the 1790s. Trees include oaks, tulip trees, hickories. Understory plants include dogwood, redbud, spicebush, Virginia creeper, honeysuckle, and grapevines. A few of the oaks, poplars, and hickories are between 200 and 300 years old. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock. And now back to you, Stuart Harris.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Alex Reinert, who's telling us all about the constitutional significance of solitary confinement.
So I think part of what's happened is there was an explosion of prison population in the 70s, and with it came an increase in some prison violence in the 70s. There was a riot. There were riots in California. There was a riot at Attica in New York. And so the response was to become more punitive. And solitary confinement is, in a way, a prison within a prison, right? It's the, we've sent people to prison for doing bad things, and now when they're in prison, they do something bad. We've got to create another prison for them within it. And so
that's a very important point, Alex, and I'd like to pause there because you've mentioned two different constitutional provisions here that are very, very relevant. Of course, one is the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And as you've said, the court has not decided that solitary, it violates the Eighth Amendment. But then you also mentioned due process. And of course, the Constitution, both the Fifth and the 14th Amendments, prohibit the federal government or the states from depriving anyone of life, liberty, or property, liberty being the relevant portion here, without due process of law. But the interesting concept you just touched upon is that there are levels of deprivation of liberty. Obviously, you're depriving someone of liberty by putting him in any prison. But these are prisons within the prison, and so it becomes relevant as to whether the prison authorities are providing some sort of procedural due process before they take a person out of the general population and put him in this prison within the prison.
That's right, and that's the issue that the Supreme Court has addressed itself over the years, more so than the issue of whether or not solitary confinement itself is cruel and unusual punishment. So let's it's great to break them apart. So as to the process, as to the process required, what the Supreme Court has said is that obviously when you've already had some process before you got into prison, you had a criminal trial or you had a plea hearing, whatever, you've had adequate process to get into prison. So once you're in prison, what process is required to put you in something more extreme? Well, the first question the court has told us we have to ask ourselves is this thing that you're putting this prisoner into, is it actually a deprivation of liberty compared to being in prison? So what they've come up with a test that says, is this thing that you're trying to do to this prisoner atypical and significant, those are the words, in relation to the ordinary incidents of prison life? So most courts will say solitary confinement is atypical and significant as long as it's of a certain duration. And that depends on where you are in the country, frankly. There's no agreement about how long the solitary confinement has to be before it becomes atypical and significant. And once it becomes atypical and significant, then you've got to provide process. But let's not fool ourselves about what the process is. So the process basically is you've got to be told what you're being charged with. You've got to be given some notice of that before you have a hearing. You do have to have a hearing. And the hearing has to be before someone who's neutral, but that just means that's pretty loosely defined. Most of the hearings are conducted by employees of the state. Sometimes they're conducted by captains in the facility. Sometimes they're conducted by lawyers who are hired by the state to conduct these hearings. So you got to have an impartial decision maker. And you have to have an opportunity to rebut the evidence or the basis for being put there, but you don't that doesn't necessarily mean you get to call witnesses. It doesn't necessarily mean you get to cross-examine someone. It doesn't necessarily mean you get access to documents that might help you rebut the challenge. And you certainly don't have access to anyone representing you, right? You don't have a lawyer or anyone else.
Okay, let me put this then. Let me just summarize and put this in a real life situation or hypothetical. Let's say I'm in prison and the guard thinks that I've done something wrong and says, okay, Harris, you're off to solitary. Now, if it's brief, I get no due process at all. Basically, he just carts me down and throws me in the cell. And whatever brief is, a few hours, a couple of days. If it's longer than whatever that period of time is, that duration is, that kicks in the atypical and significant standard, then I get some sort of process. But basically, that simply means the guard has to go to his captain and say, Captain, I want to put Harris in here. And then I'm pulled in front of the captain, and the guard tells his story, and I tell my story, and then the captain decides whether I go into the hole or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, in most systems, it might be more formal than that. You'll write up, the correction officer will write up a misbehavior report, and you'll get a copy of that, and then there'll be a hearing. But you will be held in solitary pre-hearing. That is, the presumption is you're going to go to solitary once the misbehavior report is issued, and then at the time of the hearing, they might say, well, there's no basis for this misbehavior report, and then you'd be released from solitary. And the only other thing I'd say is that sometimes the conditions may be so extreme that even confinement in them for like 3 days would be considered atypical and significant. But they'd have to be really, really extreme. Let's take the Ohio Supermax case. There, the court said, yes, this is atypical and significant. It's extreme deprivation of human contact. They didn't have to worry about duration because everyone who was in there for at least a year. So then, so they didn't really address whether or not it would be atypical and significant if it were only for 3 days.
Right.
But in any event, that's the basic framework. Yeah.
And from a prisoner's perspective, I mean, this is all still, it's all the man. I mean, it's first the guard, and then it's somebody up further in the prison hierarchy. It's all internal. I mean, there's no counsel, there's no judge who's independent in any way, shape, or form. This is all within the criminal, the penitentiary system.
It is all within the penitentiary system. As I said, sometimes the department will bring in an outside lawyer who's employed by the department to do these hearings. There's a right to appeal, but the appeal is also within the correction system. And then in New York, for instance, if you exhaust all those avenues, you can then file an action in state court saying that the decision to put you in solitary was arbitrary and capricious.
Is that a habeas petition?
That's basically a habeas petition in state court, yeah.
Okay, so those are the procedural due process constitutional issues.
On the substantive side, right, so again, for the non-lawyers out there, we lawyers tend to think of things in procedural ways and in substantive ways. So on the substantive side of things, which is basically the line that you can't cross no matter how much you give in the way of procedure, that is, there's some things you can't do no matter what the procedure is. The court just hasn't given us any guidance on whether or not solitary is cruel and unusual or when it crosses the line to being cruel and unusual. It's had a few opportunities, it just hasn't given us guidance. And I think, I think there's an argument, and if you look at the death penalty jurisprudence, it's illustrative of this. There's an argument to be made that if we think of the Eighth Amendment, the amendment that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, if we think of that amendment as representing evolving standards of decency, which is the language the court uses sometimes to talk about the Eighth Amendment, well, there's a conversation going on right now, both within this country and internationally, about whether solitary confinement is consistent with evolving standards of decency. And I think the more we have change in places like New York, New York City, New York State, there's been some change in places like Mississippi and places like Maine and Arizona, et cetera, the more we see that momentum for change, I think the more there's an argument that we're getting to a place where at least solitary confinement as it's used now is not consistent with evolving standards of decency. Now, whether we're going to get there or when we're going to get there, it's obviously anyone's guess, and I'm not the kind of person that likes to predict these things. But I do think there's an argument for it. It's an argument that some of us are making
Yeah, it's a notoriously nebulous area of constitutional law, and it drives the strict constructionist people crazy because, of course, it specifically says that we're going to interpret the Constitution based upon taking the pulse of society.
Yeah, but let's, you know, so, but let's be, if we think of it from a historical context, the early Eighth Amendment cases, and there weren't that many in the 1800s, but there were some in the 1800s. The early Eighth Amendment cases were not shy about borrowing from other countries, from international standards. They didn't think there was anything inconsistent with looking at the Eighth Amendment through the lens of some broader moral vision about what our society should be trying to accomplish. So even, you know, if I'm an originalist, let's say, or then I don't know that I necessarily am going to reject the view that the Eighth Amendment can be informed by these kinds of judgments. The concern, of course, is that, and this is a legitimate concern and a valid criticism of some of the Supreme Court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, is that in the end it just reflects the subjective values of the justices.
That's the criticism.
The court, you know, and I think that's a valid concern and a valid criticism, and I think one should try and think about the doctrine in a way that minimizes that risk. On the other hand, I will say this, you know, the reason they are judges, the reason they are Supreme Court justices is because they're supposed to exercise judgment. So,
well, there's that.
Yeah. So.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Now, I'm guessing based upon our discussion thus far, and again, just to orient ourselves constitutionally, we've talked about due process. We've talked about the Eighth Amendment. I'm guessing that the basis of your recent lawsuit in New York State was really more of an Eighth Amendment argument than it was just procedural.
It was an Eighth Amendment argument principally. It is an Eighth Amendment argument principally. There is a procedural argument about what happened to our individual clients.
Right.
But to the extent we're trying to seek relief for all prisoners within the New York State system, it's founded in a particular theory about the Eighth Amendment. Yeah.
Okay, and let's summarize that now, because based upon what you've told me, it doesn't seem that you categorically oppose solitary in every circumstance, but is it fair to say you think those circumstances are very limited?
It's fair to say that that I think those circumstances are very limited, and that I would be my idea about what solitary should sort of what conditions of confinement should be characterized by solitary confinement is different from the way it's practiced now. That is, even if I were willing to say there are some people who need to be separated and isolated for some periods of time, I don't think the extreme human deprivation that people experience right now is beneficial to anyone.
Yeah, I'm not going to make your argument for you, but I mean, if you agree on one hand that there's a small group of people that really do need to be segregated, that doesn't mean that you have to deprive them of everything. I mean, theoretically, they could have access to books, they could have access to video, they could even have some limited access with other people, prepped through a protective screen.
Yeah,
but, I mean, there would be ways to be less harsh, even as you isolate a particularly dangerous person.
I think that's all correct, and I also think those are all innovations that reformers are trying to accomplish in particular systems around the country. I mean, what's interesting is that I think from the corrections perspective, I think more and more people within corrections are coming to realize that solitary has been a failure, and that it's overused, and that we need to rethink the way it's used. And I think, I mean, one of the challenges about litigating this case in New York is that in New York, we think of ourselves as a liberal place. And there's a cognitive dissonance, I think, for people in New York to hear that our system overuses solitary more than almost any other system in the country. It's not consistent with our own view of ourselves as a progressive place, and our use of solitary reflects anything but progressivism. So it's interesting that some of the reforms that have been successful have been in a place like Mississippi, right?
It defies the expectation. Let's summarize again what exactly was settled in your case. You recently reached a settlement with New York State. What exactly came out of your case then?
So what came out of the case is a few things. First, they were going to not put certain people in solitary, juveniles, women who were pregnant, people with developmental disabilities. They were going to try and divert those people to other programs to help them adjust their behavior without putting them into solitary. So that's one thing. But the vast majority of people don't necessarily fall into that category. So the second thing it did is it imposed sentencing guidelines on the use of solitary for the first time in the New York State system, which is kind of shocking. Before this settlement agreement, basically a hearing officer had a tremendous amount of discretion as to what sentence to give individuals for any number of different infractions. So now we have a sentencing grid, a sentencing guideline. Now, we're not satisfied with that guideline. We still think it's too high, but at least it channels some of the discretion that the hearing officers have. And then I think the third thing, which is also extremely important, is we have this two-year window in which, and we're basically right in the middle of it, we've gone through a year of it so far, in which we're engaged constantly with the state in a collaborative process trying to reach a final settlement agreement that will impose additional reforms that further improve the use of solitary. So that may be reforms to the sentencing grid, that may be reforms to the way that people are sentenced. All sorts of different things are on the table. And that's a process that's being driven by two very, very qualified experts with experience in the correction system. And so it's and with that process, we're also getting a lot of data from the state, and the state is getting a lot of data that it never had gotten before to help us really understand where we can find ways to reduce the use of solitary. I mean, the state, to its credit, I think, is interested in trying to reduce the use of solitary without increasing the risk of harm or safety to people within the prison system.
Well, Alex, it sounds like you've won a great victory, but it also sounds like you have your work cut out for you over the next couple of years. This has been fascinating. Any final thoughts before we finish up?
No, I think what you said just captured it perfectly. We do feel like we've accomplished something, but we also feel like there's a lot more to be done both in New York and around the country. And so we hope that New York can be a model, and we certainly will be looking to other jurisdictions to be a model for us.
Well, Alex Reinhardt of the Cardozo School of Law in New York City, and the man who single-handedly messed up civil procedure in the entire United States forever and ever, it seems.
Let's give Justice Kennedy some credit.
Thank you very, very much for your time. We appreciate it, and thank you for speaking with us today.
Yeah. Thank you. Great to talk to you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Alex Reinhardt for telling us all about solitary confinement, a disturbing topic, but an important one. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. And my goodness gracious, thanks also to Rechna, who's here with us today in the studio, listening in her idyllic little girl way. You know, she's so young that she did not even see Star Wars. How can one not see Star Wars? My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.